Welcome to the Oldie Podcast. This is from our literary lunch featuring guest speakers and kindly sponsored by Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. Our lunches are held monthly. Details and how to book can be found in our magazine and on the website at www.theoldie.co.uk.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming here today. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe, The Oldie. And we are only here thanks to our wonderful sponsors, Charles Stanley. Thank you so much. I'm a very poor imitation of our late great MC, the great Barry Cryer, who still accounts for a third of the Oldie's website traffic with his weekly jokes. And this is the latest from Dear Barry. So there's an old man walking down the street at 2 a.m. He's stumbling and holding a glass. So a policeman stops him and asks him where he's going. And he said, I'm going to a lecture. And the policeman says, at 2 a.m, sir, what's the lecture about? Smoking and drinking, the old man says. And the policeman said, well, who's giving it? And he says, my wife. Now, we've got three terrific speakers here today. And the first speaker is a world expert on a subject close to oldie readers' hearts, wine. He is Henry Jeffries, an award-winning wine critic who writes for The Telegraph, The Spectator. You can forget about them, most importantly, The Oldie. He wrote The Cocktail Dictionary, and his latest book he's going to write, talk about today is Vines in a Cold Climate, The People Behind the English Wine Revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, Henry Jeffries.
Hello, everyone. I hope you've all enjoyed the wine. There was no English wine, sadly, but anyway. It's a great honour to be here at an Oldie Literary Lunch. Thank you, Harry. Thank you, James, for inviting me. One of my first jobs was in publishing, and I used to go to the Oldie Literary Lunches, used to escort elderly authors there when they were at Simpsons in the Strand. And one time it was with Keith Waterhouse, and I was told I mustn't let him drink too much before lunch, otherwise he won't make the speeches. But he completely ignored me and drank a bottle before lunch, and everything was fine. So I'm here to tell you about my book, which is called Vines in a Cold Climate, The People Behind the English Wine Revolution. It's about English wine. I must say that I was approached in 2021 to write this book, and I had no interest in doing it at all. Not that I didn't like English wines, I'd enjoyed a few of them, but I thought there was no story there. They all seemed to be some bloke called Dominic, made a packet in the city, planted some vines in Kent and Sussex with the idea of making England's answer to Paul Roget. It was all a bit sort of golf umbrella and branded gilet. So I thought, you know, this is really boring. I might as well be writing about accountancy firms or, you know, Accenture or something. And also there were some other wonderful books about English wine. So Oz Clark had written about a book, and I thought, you know, if Oz Clark's written the book about it, why would I go there? And so I was sort of mulling it over because I was, you know, honoured to be asked to do a book, but I was not very keen. I was invited for lunch by this very strange Frenchman called Jérôme Moissin. He owns a company that makes cosmetics from leftovers from winemaking. But that's not what's strange about him. What's strange about him is he collects English wine. So he must be the only Frenchman in the whole of France who collects English wine. And he organized this lunch to show off his cosmetics. And then we had this wine there, and it was a 92 Nightimber Blanc de Blanc. So this is the first great English wine. It was made by an American couple called Sandy and Stuart Moss. And I, trying it 30 years later, I thought, you know, this is wonderful. And then Jerome dropped in that he knew the Mosses, and he had their email, and he had a file of cuttings that he handed over to me based on their struggles to make wine in Sussex in the 1990s. And I thought, you know, this is a sign. I have to do this book. And at the lunch, there was someone else there, and he was a producer who I won't name because he said some libelous things. No, I will name him, actually. His name was Adrian Pike, and he was from a vineyard down the road from us in Kent called Westwell. And he was bracingly candid about other people in the industry. There was one producer who treated his workers so abysmally that he couldn't keep hold of them, and there was one ambitious billionaire who was simply a fucking twat. This is Adrian's words, not mine. I'm not going to say that. And I thought, someone else later told me about another English wine producer who's famous for his violent outbursts. I won't say who it was. It was Eric Karima. This is all. You know, what's it called? Chatham House rules. Yeah. He's the current owner of Nye Timber. I mean, he was banned from the Savoy for smashing plates in a drunken outburst. And his father was a Nazi. I don't mean that he had, you know, trenchant views on immigration. He actually got married in his SS uniform. So, and I thought to myself, this isn't boring at all. You know, there's so many stories here. It turns out the English wine industry is full of these larger-than-life figures who have no qualms about speaking their minds extremely emphatically. So anyway, the industry is full of all these kind of characters, and none of them were quite as indiscreet as a chap called Owen Elias, who was winemaker at Chapel Down and now at a place called Balfour. And much of what he told me about the early days of Chapel Down actually had to be removed by the libel lawyers. But what is left gives you a little flavour of him. So he described the early years of Chapel Down dealing with shits, charlatans, liars, people with more money than you. And he said it was a difficult process to combat. And then he added with triumph that they all disappeared in the end. And then he told me about 200,000 litres of wine that someone had dropped off that he didn't know what to do with because it was about 8% high acidity, totally unsellable. And I said, what did you do with it? And he goes, we had a fire. And then his eyes lit up, and then he added, it wasn't deliberate, though everyone thought it was, but apparently they had really, really good insurance. And I hasten to add that nothing like that goes on in English wine anymore. It's a lot worse. So I thought to myself, you know, there's a brilliant story here. With all the big egos and money, it's a bit like Dallas, you know, on the South Downs. Or maybe Howard's Way, you know, not quite Dallas. And all the other books about English wine had been called, you know, a celebration of English wine. You know, they were all about the good side of the industry. And I thought, why don't I write about the bad side of the industry? Why don't I write about people falling out? Oh, there's a diarist here. Please don't mention that I've been rude about Eric Karima. Okay, because I mean, it's all in the Times. But let's be, because I don't want to get a letter from his lawyers. So anyway, I thought I'll write the book like an extended gossip column. It'll all about these big egos and stuff. And most people in the industry have taken it quite well, though Owen Elias's boss is not talking to me anymore, so it's not very good. I had this wonderful message from Stephen Skelton, who is the sort of Mr. English wine, and he wrote to me, I've just read Vines in a Cold Climate, and I've never read a wine book so full of swear words and blasphemies. And I should add that most of the swear words and blasphemies came from Stephen, who is the most foul-mouthed person you've ever met. And he went on to say, I hope the publisher has a good libel lawyer on speed dial. But thankfully, not until now, I haven't had any letters from any lawyers, and let's hope that doesn't happen yet. So the book is the scarcely believable story of how English wine went from a joke to world class in a little over 30 years. Nowadays you have French companies, Californian companies, German, Spanish companies, all investing in English wine, which, you know, 30 years ago you just couldn't predict. So I'm going to go back in time a bit. The reputation of wine made in the British Isles was so low in the 19th century that Punch magazine joked that it would take four men to drink a British wine, two to hold the victim down and one to pour it down his neck. So that was English wine. Things picked up a bit after the Second World War when you had these double-barrel blazer people like Major General Sir Guy Salisbury Jones at Hambledon who planted vines. And had some success, the first commercial English vineyard for a long time. But some people still had a problem with the very idea of English wine. So Sir Guy Salisbury-Jones tried to export some wine to France, and it was impounded at Orly Airport. And he wrote, "The wine seemed to have aroused the suspicions of the French douan, who could not believe that England produced wine." And then wine merchant Stephen Spurrier had a similar problem when he tried to organise wine to be served at the British Embassy to Georges Pompidou and Queen Elizabeth II. He was curtly said the wine was impounded again by French customs, and he was curtly informed that English wine does not exist. I was really kind of curious to know, what were these wines like, these sort of early commercial English wines from after the war? And so I asked Oz Clark about them, and he said, "I had a few, and gosh, they were hard work." And he described this one wine, which I think is well worth reading in full. It was a 1976 West Sussex wine, which he opened in 2011, and I'm going to read his quote here. "I cracked it open, and this pale, unfriendly liquid forced its way out, indignant at having been disturbed, and as lemon-lipped and cantankerous as it had been at its inception. Proud, unbending, yes. Fun to drink, definitely not." So how did English wine go from there to what we have today? So the climate has played a very big part. One English winemaker, Peter Hall, described the 70s as the bloody awful weather years. But it's more than just a story about the weather. It's about a few determined, some might say bloody-minded people, from the city types with nothing but a dream and a massive checkbook, to a single mother working a few acres in Kent. It's the story of a few men and women with big personalities who ignored the doubters like me and thought not only could you make drinkable wine in England, you could make something truly world-class. My wife, however, is still yet to be convinced. And
I love the sparkling.
She likes the sparkling wine, but often I'll open a bottle of wine and I'll get very excited about it. And she goes, "Is it good or is it just good for England?" Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Henry. Thank you all so much for coming to the Oldie Lunch. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Oldie Podcast. Please share this episode. Look out for the Oldie Magazine subscription offer on our website, www.theoldie.co.uk. Thank you and good luck.